Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hello and welcome to Raising a Pro. I'm Annie Apple, journalist and NFL mom to my son, Eli Apple. Today, I'm talking to Sabrina Greenlee, mother of Arizona Cardinals star wide receiver DeAndre Hopkins. And we all will never forget the recent game where DeAndre was on the other half of catching the Hail Mary, as it's being called, with Kyler Murray throwing the ball in the end zone, seconds left in the Bills game, surrounded by 3 Bills defenders, caught it in the end zone, game's over. DeAndre Hopkins was money. I mean money. So today we're talking football and we're talking life and how a criminally abusive ex-boyfriend almost took Sabrina's life, but he could not take away her courage and her resilience. Here's Sabrina Greenlee, mother, survivor, and role model with an infectious joy for life.
Oh, thank you for having me. You know, I mean, how can I top that intro? Thank you so much.
I'm just glad you're here. Let's get to the beginning. At what age did DeAndre start to play football?
Actually, DeAndre started playing Little League when he was 5. So where we live, and I still currently live, they had a Little League team. And they could start at the age of 5. So I went out there one day, and as all of my kids have, DeAndre's the 3rd child, of course. So previously, the other 2 kids played football, even Keisha, my daughter. So they let girls play back then.
No way. Are you serious?
Yeah. Of course, I was getting the side eye as a mother because it's like, how could you let this girl play? But she was so tough and she wanted to play. So she played. And so DeAndre definitely had a lot of role models coming up. And his sister was the first one because she was so tough.
What position did Keisha play?
Wide receiver as well.
Wow.
And even now, she's still a part of a women's league. Yeah. So she's still playing football.
So you have DeAndre, you have Marcus, Shantaria, and Keisha.
Yeah. So they're all very athletic. And all we've ever known was sports, football, basketball, volleyball, you name it. They had me so busy. So I go out here one day and DeAndre is 5 years old. And of course, at that time, they're slanging their jerseys around, you know, the poor little kids, they're getting tossed everywhere. But he stands there, they hand him the ball and he throws this ball like half of a football length. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, that's my baby, you know? So that's when I knew. I said, this kid has something special. So DeAndre, a lot of people don't know, he was a quarterback. From that day, he was a quarterback up until high school.
Really?
He decided his 9th grade year that he wasn't going to play football anymore. He said, I'm done. I want to play basketball. That's where I want to go. So this is me coming up with all of these things as a mother. So I remember, you know, his father passed away when he was only 6 months old. So he was determined not to play this year. So the coach came in and he begged DeAndre. Now, mind you, the head coach came in the house. DeAndre's laying in the bed. I hear this grown man in there pleading with him to play. So I'm thinking, OK, what can I do? He is not going to play. So I go in there after the coach leaves. And so I tell DeAndre, I said, I had a vision last night. Your father came to me. And he told me that you need to play. I was totally fabricating everything, but I was trying to do everything I can to get this kid to play. So he would not play. So he went out. He really didn't play that year. So he went out his 10th grade year. His punishment for not playing previously the year before was they put him at wide receiver. So he was really mad and he decided he was going to go out there. And to make everybody mad, he was going to go out here and just like catch every ball and be mad and show them that he didn't care that they didn't put him at quarterback.
Wow.
Like he excelled at being a receiver. He literally had. So he played both positions that year. He got 14 interceptions in 1 year as a corner and he got like tremendous amount of receptions as a wide receiver. So that's how he became a wide receiver.
I never knew that's how he became a wide receiver.
Out of protest.
Out of protest
and still protesting, may I add.
They thought they were punishing him to put him wide receiver, but really it just all came together because he's one of the most prolific wide receiver in the league. 2017, he was the NFL receiving touchdown leader, right? So you have to be proud of him. Don't go anywhere because I'm going to get deeper into my conversation with Sabrina in just a minute. But now I have a great message for you. For those of you who are getting to know me, you know I am all about self-care. Anything we can do to make ourselves feel good and nourish from the inside out sits well with me. And for many of us, that starts with what we eat. Yes. Sakara is a nutrition company that focuses on overall wellness and can help you reach your health goals without sacrificing on taste. And let me tell you something. For me, taste is everything. And their truffle salad dressing is to die for. Anyway, they have a huge menu of delicious, ready-to-eat, chef-crafted breakfasts, lunches, and dinners. All delivered fresh and directly to you, no matter where you reside in the United States. The menu changes weekly, so there's no chance you're going to get bored with what's on your plate. And for a limited time, Sakara is granting you early access to their only sale of the year with 25% site-wide with code RAP Black Friday. That's R-A-P Black Friday. That's 25% off your entire order when you go to Sakara.com and enter the code RAP Black Friday at checkout. Enter the code RAP Black Friday at checkout for 25% off your entire order. That's Sakara, S-A-K-A-R-A.com. Don't say I've never given you anything. Let's get to kind of how the changes you talked about, his father passing away when he was a baby. Tell me about that. What was that like for you and the family?
It was tough as a family. I actually met his father when I was 19 and he passed away when I was 23. He was 28. We're in a car accident and the car hydroplaned coming back from Georgia. Unfortunately, the car landed on a guardrail and crushing in a couple of his organs, which caused him to bleed out on me. So as they're cutting me out of the car, I'm thinking that this is my blood, but actually it was all of his blood. And he passed away 8 days later in the hospital. So having to come back home and kiss my 6-month-old baby, it was really tough trying to raise then, which would have been 3 kids, without a father, without a role model in the house. So it made it really tough as a mother, as a single mother, to have to step into that fatherly role. So DeAndre definitely was a fatherless child. I didn't really know what to do or how to do it. I just knew that I wanted to give him a chance at life. And it was really tough. As he grew, he asked a lot of questions I did not have the answer to. I knew I had to play both roles. And so there was a lot of discipline in my home. We had this rule, Annie, and that was the 15-minute rule. So every time that DeAndre asked me a question, he would ask it. And you know, sometimes it was questions that, like I said, I didn't know the answer to. And then there were some that I could answer because I had only known his father for going on 4 years. And so there were some things that his grandmother needed to answer. But as far as being who his father was and how I portrayed him and people in the community portrayed him, I had that. But then you had those emotional questions because he wanted the why. Why is my father not here? Why does my friend have fathers and I don't? So I had to deal with the why, the emotional part. And when he asked those questions, we had the 15-minute rule. And I remember just thinking to myself, what can I do? So he would, like I said, ask the tough questions. I would answer them as best I could. And I would walk out of the room and I said, I'll be back in 15 minutes. When I come back in 15 minutes, you have 15 minutes to cry. Get it all out. Mm. And so when I come back in the room, I would say, are you done? He didn't know what I was doing, but I knew that what I was doing was I was setting him up so that he would not be that strong Black man to have pity or to feel like he was missing something. So what I would say is, you know, God didn't deal you a father hand, but he dealt you a darn good mama hand. and he dealt you a family hand. And so these are the cards that you were dealt. You don't have a father. What do we do? There's certain things that I can't give you, but I can give you my motherly love. And this is, you know, this is what you have to deal with. And he had 15 minutes to cry. And it worked. It actually worked. He tells me now, he jokes with me. He says, "Mama, don't you get my babies in a room?" And he said, "They need more than 15 minutes to cry, you know." But he has three kids. He said, "Keep mama away from my babies. She won't let them cry."
You know? She give them 17 minutes.
exactly. We're up at 2 minutes. But he, like I said, he was always inquisitive about, you know, who his father was, his family. And like I said, I answered it the best I could, but even in the midst of all of that, I knew that he was special. I knew that this kid was going to be someone that people would admire because he was curious and he was just admired early, even by me. You know, of course, I couldn't let him know, but his work ethics and the things that he did was just over the top.
I mean, he had a good example. And, you know, when we speak of tragedy, you know, you lost two brothers. You lost one brother in a tragic car accident. And then your brother, Terry, who I understand played wide receiver at Clemson, which DeAndre ended up going to Clemson. He was shot and killed. So it's how, you know, you gave DeAndre 15 minutes, right? But how were you able to deal with those massive losses in your own life?
Oh, one thing after another. You spoke about my brother, Terry. When I think about him, I think of him being my hero. I can't help but smile because I actually raised him. I put him through 5 years of Clemson. He was drafted into the NFL in the Indianapolis Colts. Of course, he was injured and he had to come home. He was rehabbing in Atlanta. So him being like my best friend, it was tough. Mm-hmm. It was really tough. When I think about what got me through was just those memories of us, our childhood, always being close, always having this really tight bond. And I knew that he wasn't with me anymore. He passed away in 1997. You know, by then I had my three children and I poured all of my energy into them. Football was in our family. So I really, really focused on my boys, making it into the league, making sure that the academics was right, making sure that me and the high school counselor were best friends.
I think about when you were saying all the things that you had to do, it just took me back because people don't understand how much work goes into getting your kid ready to play at a high level in high school. First of all, that's the only way you get the opportunity in college. And all the academic requirement. I remember Eli wanted to early enroll at Ohio State. So like 2 years before, we knew there were extra classes he had to take, classes in the summer and all these things so he can be the first one from his school to graduate early, to leave early, right? So all the intricacies of the hard work behind the scenes to get them where they are. So how was the recruiting for DeAndre and what made Clemson the right choice for him?
As I spoke about, my brother went to Clemson. We were from Clemson. So DeAndre, it wasn't difficult for him to be a Tiger or be a fan of Clemson because that's all he knew. I remember him coming home one day saying that, "Are you ready to go to California?" And I said, "I am not moving to California." So he tells me later, he says that that made my choice to go to Clemson because I wasn't ready to leave you. So at this time I was dealing with surgeries and I had gotten hurt and it was a lot of things that factored into that decision. But going back to the recruiting stage, it was a process. I mean, as I said, I had the counselor on speed dial and I was very active, even though I had gotten hurt and it was a tough time in our household. But the one thing I knew was that I needed to make my presence known in the school because I was not going to allow them to be the defining factor of where my son goes and, you know, his classes that he was in. And so fortunately, I had Keisha and Marcus that went before him. So I knew firsthand that he needed to be in two languages, foreign languages. He needed three mathematics and he needed four English classes. And, you know, core classes, all these things that I was privy to prior to DeAndre going to college. So it wasn't that hard to figure out that he needed these things in order to get into a Division I college. I was not allowing him to go to a junior college. Like, that just wasn't an option.
And you know what? Listening to you, it sounds like, oh, that's just so, that's a lot, but that's mundane. But let's take this back to July of 2002 to understand how just courageous and the love that you have for all your children, and especially DeAndre in this phase of his life, how powerful that this moment you talk about is. We go back to July 2002. Tell us about that day.
Wow, that day. So as I always talk about, when I talk about this day, July 20th, 2002, you're looking at a 30-year-old woman with four children at home. And I can't talk about that day without having to go back. I was broken way before that day. You're looking at someone who didn't know her worth, was empty. There was a void there from previous things happening in my childhood that led up to my adolescence and then trickling down into me being a grown woman. So this particular day, I was dating a guy. I had only been knowing him 3 months, almost 4 months. And what I call it, Annie, is mashing the gas. So this man, within 4 months, he had the keys to my home, my car, my heart, and access to my children. Why? Because I decided I want to date, not thinking, what am I dating? Who am I dating? And why am I dating? I dealt with the first person that said, oh, I love you, you're beautiful, and oh, I care, and all those things that they tell you. The red flags were there from the beginning, the deceit, the manipulation, the lies. I overlooked them because I wanted a man. And so moving forward to this particular day, he had taken my car. And as I got up, I left my 4-year-old at the door screaming for me because I was like, I got to go find my car. Why did he take my car? And as I'm headed that way, where I think he gives me a call. So he tells me to come to this place. I pull up behind my Lexus. As he comes out of an apartment building, which I know now was a lady that he had been dating, he grabs my arm. And as he's tussling me, I realize that he has this death grip on my wrist, my two wrists. I'm trying to pull away. He's not letting me. He turns my back to this apartment complex, the door. And a young lady comes out by the name of Savannah, and she calls my name and she splashes me with a concoction. This concoction is Red Devil I mixed with Clorox. So I fall to the ground. My breath gets shallow. And mind you, this is a beautiful Saturday and the sun is bright, and I find myself laying on my back. So my skin has slid off of my face, my neck, my chest, and my back. Each time I try to get up, it's not happening. I can't get up and I'm dying. So I don't, you know, I'm assuming he felt sorry for me, or it didn't kind of go as they thought, like, what's going on? So he picks me up. He puts me in my brand new Lexus that I had just purchased 2 weeks prior. And he takes me up to a gas station. He gets me in there and they get me to the water fountain, and he leaves me there to die. He's scared. He don't know, like, the plan went wrong. And so they fly me to Augusta Burn Center. I am induced into a coma, and I was in a coma for a month. I wake up blind and I come home eventually after being addicted to morphine. I'm having to go through therapy for that before I even come home, because the morphine has me hallucinating, and it's a really bad time. But I finally make it home after almost 2 months, and I come home to my four children totally blind. And that is when the depression set in, the anxiety, the suicidal thoughts. It was a really, really tough time for my family and I. I think the kids, they didn't know what to think, what to say, how to comfort me.
How old were they all at this time? I think DeAndre was about 10. How old were, like, all the kids?
Yes, DeAndre was 10. Marcus was 13. My oldest, Keisha, was 14. And Shantara, the baby, was 4.
So now they have to get used to your new reality. But more importantly, you have to get used to it. What was that like daily? And how did you push yourself to the other side?
Actually, this, what I describe it as, is our abnormally new normal, because it was definitely not something that we were prepared for. but this is our new reality. And when I think back, Annie, I think about the process of healing, which was, you know, it wasn't overnight, but I began to realize that my children were worth fighting for. And so every day I got up, it was just trying to affirm that everything was okay when it really wasn't. I didn't know at this time how my family was going to turn out, how I was even going to turn out, because I had many suicidal thoughts, even down to knowing exactly how I wanted to end my life. It was a lot of dark nights. I must say there were aha moments where the kids, you know, would come in and make me feel, you know, like a mother, because everything was lost. Like it felt like all hope was lost. I remember DeAndre coming in the room one day, and I was determined no one was going to see me, my face. I mean, we live in a small town, so you got all these rumors going around. My family wouldn't let anyone in. So, of course, people was assuming the worst. And I remember him coming in saying that, "Mom, I don't care that you can't see. I just want you there. Like, this kid just wants me there. How can I continue to let him down?" So I mustered up the strength to finally attend one of his functions with all stares at me and people wondering, like, you know, what happened? And is she ever going to tell us the truth? All these things. But I did it. I finally did it. That was one of the aha moments that I say that gave me the strength to and the courage to continue going. And I kept going and I kept going. And, you know, I had someone beside me in my ear the whole time, you know, describing every little thing that happened. But I want to say that most importantly, I began to get on the process of forgiving myself. It was very important for me because all these things that I said happened and I allowed to happen in my household to myself. I had to forgive myself for this. This was not something that no one else could do but me.
And, you know, I'm thinking back at what you said earlier when you, you know, when you described this relationship or what led you to it. You said, "I just wanted to date." And I know for many survivors of domestic violence, and I am one, the hardest part is forgiving yourself because, you know, domestic violence is one of those crimes that the victim is the one who's always blamed. Well, what did you do? What did you say? What were you wearing? You know, it was like, it's like we are always responsible for the abuser's actions, you know, and then going back and living in your head and be like, okay, what could I have done? What, I mean, that is such heavy weight. And I'm so grateful that the first thing you did was take that weight off of you.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't deserve to be left for dead like a dog, you know, in the street. But in that moment, I felt unworthy. I mean, I wasn't that. I mean, they treated me how I viewed myself. And so it was only when I began to, and I had to realize that, like, you know, taking accountability to what got me to that place was important, because there were some things that I should not have allowed. People were around me that should not have been around me. So I had to take accountability of how I got to that place in the first place. And then I began the process of healing.
So little DeAndre comes into your room and says, "Mom, I don't care if you can see. I just want you there."
Yes.
Those are such powerful words, because your presence meant more to him at the time than it even meant to you.
Absolutely. Now I understand it, because we're still doing the same thing. I could be super tired and he calls me. He's like, "Are you coming? Son, what?" Like, he wants me at every home game.
Yes.
He still just wants me there. He knew something even then that I didn't know. And that was that he wanted my presence there. I'm still his mother. And even though I lost sight of being their mother, they never did.
Wow. You know, how did the children adjust to this new normal?
I think there were pros and cons to everything. Keisha became a little more rebellious. DeAndre became more active. He poured himself into his sports to the point where he would only come home at night. You have Keisha that was a little rebellious. So I'm having to like track her down because home wasn't home. There were a lot of things going on. A lot of people in and out of my home, my nightstand. at one point had 52 prescriptions on it. So I took medicine to wake up, medicine to go to bed, medicine to think, medicine to not think. And there was a lot of people in and out of my home from the people that came to do therapy because I couldn't move my neck, my arm at this point. I could barely open the right side of my mouth. It was tough. But then you have Shani, bless her heart. She was four. She actually didn't come to me for the first 3 months after I was home because she said that that's not my mommy. That's a monster. Oh, it was just a lot of ups and downs. But I think the main thing was me making my mind up to pull my family back together was very important. It was very, very important to me. I saw everybody kind of going their separate ways. And so I vowed, I was determined to pull everybody back together. So I think when I say, how did they handle it? They didn't handle it well. We didn't handle it well because I'm in there depressed. And so 3 years, I came out of my room to only go to the doctor and I was back in the room for 3 whole years. So the kids were definitely spiraling out of control. I think around beginning of that fourth year, there were a lot of times when I was very absent in the home because I was in the hospital trying to regain sight. So there was no discipline. There was no control. There was no mother to say definitely. And no, you know, none of their fathers have ever been present. So it was a lot of rebelling going on, a lot of them taking care of themselves. And so I knew that, like I said, I stepped back in as a mother. It was really tough to pull everybody together. And so this is where we start having the family meetings and holding each other accountable. And I would hold those at least once a month. And once again, like I said, I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew that I wanted to do something different. I did not want them to grow up like I did. It was very important that I pulled my family back together.
But you were doing the best you knew how with what you had. You know, you can only do the best you can with what you got. When you get more and you learn more, you do better. But until then, you were doing the best you can.
Yeah. And I I had to realize that, but I'm hard on myself. And I've always been my worst critic. You know, I was like, you know, how could I do this? But like I said, sitting those kids down, apologizing was huge for us. It was therapeutic to set these kids down and say, you know what? I'm sorry. I'm not perfect. But one thing I will know for sure is that I made a lot of mistakes, but I can promise you that I'm going to give you a peace of mind that you need to go on through life. And I won't make those same mistakes. Now, I'm going to make mistakes, but it won't be those same mistakes. And I've honored those promises to this very day.
So we know DeAndre went to Clemson. Tell me about the experience at Clemson.
I was not allowed to move him in. So this is what he tells me. He says, you remember when I told you I was going to L.A. to school? Act like I'm still in L.A.
He's so grown. Don't they get real grown real quick?
Yes. He is like, I need you to act like I am not here. How I found out where DeAndre was even living was because he had to call me and tell me that the sprinkler alarms went off in the apartment. Everything was getting wet and he needed my help.
Wow.
He was determined not to let me know. And I said, I've taken my other two kids to college. I'm taking you to school. And he was like, no, you're not. So he went behind my back and he packed all his things and he went to school. But I mean, him going to Clemson was one of the best experiences that I can remember because I got to cook for the games and tailgate and all of my friends still remember all those great memories and just being in that atmosphere. I don't care where you go. There is nothing like Death Valley.
I mean, he had a great time at Clemson and then time for the draft. What was that whole draft experience like for you guys?
Oh, it was amazing. Just knowing that he got to that point. And of course, he went out his third year. So he had another year left at Clemson. And, you know, now, you know, they have this thing where you go to college, you're three in and out. Well, back then, you know, everybody was kind of looking at him like, you know, you're not going to get your degree. How could you leave? But DeAndre was focused from the very beginning on getting his family to another level. So when he made that decision to leave as a junior, it wasn't a surprise.
So 2013, he makes the decision to leave. And what people don't understand, I try to explain to people, because my son left in his, you know, after his third year too. The whole objective of college, right? Whether you play football, whether you're going to be a school teacher, the whole objective of college is to put yourself in position to make a living, right? So if you can do that in 3 years, go do that. You know, because the great thing is, if they want to pursue their degree, they can always come back and do it. But people look at them like sad. I'm like, college is about taking you to the next level.
Making his life and his family's life better.
Yeah.
So he did. He went into the NFL draft his junior year. And I knew it wasn't going to be a surprise, because this kid was very determined from the very beginning. Going into the draft that day, I mean, I still remember like it was yesterday. I sat there. So I got this little joke about drafts. So we invite 50 to 60 people. I'm in charge of the invites. They come in, they get drink tickets. We're in our little community restaurant and bar there in Central. Everything is going great. So I get there, and DeAndre has, so ESPN, you have all these lights. We're at the table, and all of my friends are like circling around me. Everybody's having fun. It's got 50 people, from coaches to friends to school teachers. I mean, you name it. Everybody that had an influence in DeAndre's life is in this building. And he will not let me get up. I'm sitting there. He gets up. He's speaking. People keep coming up to me. He's like, "Don't move." And I'm like, "Don't move." I was like, "Why can't I get up?" He's like, "Don't move. You never know. Don't move." So, but what I don't realize is he's nervous. I've never seen this kid nervous before, but he's taking his nervous energy out on me. So he's telling me, "Don't move."
Because he needs your presence right there. Your presence, like your voice, is so soothing.
Oh, thank you. I'm always talking about my voice being raspy. And so I have this joke. I said, "Oh my God. So when I wake up in the morning, I sound like DMX. I go to bed Beyonce. I just don't know." So, but yeah, so thank you. So that's funny. So he's got me there. And so New England was the team that kept, you know, looking at him. And we just knew we was going to the New England Patriots. And so then they make a pick, and they passed. So now he's really nervous. We're sitting there. The little joke is, he looks over and he taps me, because I have some sight at this point, just slightly. But he taps me. He says, "Man, so what are we going to do with all this food? And I know people got to come back tomorrow, because we got this buffet. We got this whole spread, and everybody's eating and happy. So nobody hears this but me." And I reach over and I tell him, I said, "Well, I know one thing. If everybody got to come back tomorrow, they're not eating a buffet." I said, "We eating chicken wings and fries." And so he says, "All right, so you're going to set that up, because we're probably going to be coming back tomorrow." By this time, his agent goes and put the Houston Texans hat on. And he reaches over. He was like, "Scratch the chicken wings. I think we good. You know, and I was just like, because we're up here preparing for the next day. And, it, you know, secretly, because we got all these people that may have to come back. But he's like, "Scratch the chicken wings. I think we good." And I'm over here taking a deep breath, like, because I didn't know how I was going to feed all these people again. I was like, whew. So as he sees this, his agent goes and puts the Houston Texans hat on, that by that time it was like the 23rd draft pick in the first round.
Yeah, he was 27th overall, right?
27th. Yep. Yeah.
So, okay. So he goes to Houston, balling out. You got Bill O'Brien, who is his head coach, right? Let's just pause there. In that moment, you're taking it, he's drafted. Like, his professional career is starting. You're taking it in based on everything you've had to bring your family through. What is that feeling like for you?
Oh, it felt good. It was surreal. I was just focused on DeAndre. He's young.
Tell me about, people don't understand how young our sons are when they get into this league.
I did not want to leave him. So I remember one of his agents saying, "Should I book us a flight?" And I remember him saying, "No, I'm taking my mom." So I'm thinking, it's just me and him. Here we go, you know. But they welcomed him. Everything was so good. But here I am. I stayed there an entire week with him, you know, him and I just sitting around, and him describing the city to me, and him making me feel more comfortable, you know, just being able to leave in a couple of days. Cause I was like, "Man, I don't know. You know, DeAndre is young, you know, it's a big city, it's Houston." And so my my focus was all on him and just trying, because he was so young.
And so he's the first, whether he was the second wide receiver ever drafted in the first round in the Houston Texans history. He goes there and just has phenomenal career. What happened at the end of his tenure there that you just felt, or he just felt like it was time to find another team?
There was a couple of years that had went by that DeAndre was just playing. He didn't feel appreciated. And him and I talked, to be very transparent. His thing is, he says, "Mama, when a grown man can walk by you and not look you in your eyes, it's time to go."
Ooh, can you say that again? See, people don't understand that leadership is about vulnerability. Vulnerability is the hallmark of leadership. A lot of these coaches, their interpersonal communication skills is off.
Totally off. And they treat these kids as an object. And, you know, even though it's a way out, it's a blessing. But once you're in that system, I mean, the way that they treat you is just, it's unheard of. And I thank God that DeAndre never lost himself in the process. Like, he is just who he is. And because of that is why, you know, we're on another team. Like, DeAndre is not a yes man. DeAndre is very private. And when asked about his life, he takes that personal. It's like, I'm giving you 100% of me, what is required of me. I don't feel I need to be your best friend.
I'm not here to be liked, but I'm here to be respected because I'm a human being. Yeah. So for DeAndre, it was like, okay, it may be time to go. How did you adjust to that decision for him before it was even made?
Him and I had already talked about it the very last game in the playoff. When he called me, he was the last one in the locker room, and he was like, "Oh man, you know," and he wasn't happy. And I told him, I said, "DeAndre, what you need to realize is that there are decisions that need to be made. And this team that you're on, this is as far as you're probably going to go." And I won't go into everything that we said, but of course, as everyone can kind of figure, things that transpired over the years with the Texans and Dallas and that region in itself, and things that, you know, people in authoritative positions said about players. And so I think everybody will kind of figure out where I'm going with that. But it was his time. So it wasn't a surprise. He called me right before and he said, "It's happening." I already knew what it was.
So March of 2020, he's traded to the Arizona Cardinals. What was that like for you? He's like, "Okay, I'm going to have to switch colors."
I know. I had my friend come in, and my thing was, I need to throw everything away but my jersey. But I do now. The thing about what I want to make very clear is I love Houston.
Yeah, it is a beautiful city.
I have family there, people that I call family. In the city, it's nothing like Houston. I mean, and then the fans are still, I mean, they love DeAndre. They embraced us. So that will never change. I have a place in Houston. I love Houston. But it was just time for DeAndre to elevate.
And elevate he is, and he has. So let's get back. Okay, what part of you do you see in DeAndre when you just think at everything he's been able to accomplish, and he's still so young? You know, what are some of your great traits that you see in him?
Oh, all of me. He's stubborn. He is passive aggressive, curious. He's nosy. Like, I'm a little nosy too. But what I see in DeAndre is just his willingness to overachieve, become better and better and better. And that's what I strive for. You know, every day I want to be a better person to everyone around me. And DeAndre is a giver. He is a giver first, never a taker. And so I see that trait in him. But just to making everyone around you better, whether that's good or bad, direct or indirect, but whatever it takes to make everyone around you better. That's what DeAndre does. And that's what I appreciate most about him. And even that's me. He calls me and we have good, real conversations. still. And I know that no matter what, he just wants to make me better. And likewise.
That is awesome. And what is advice that you gave DeAndre when it comes to dating? I know now he's a father of three, but what are some advice that you, you know, important advice that you gave him when it was time for him to date?
Always be kind. Always be considerate. Treat a woman how you would treat your mother, because that's very important, you know. And DeAndre, we end each conversation with saying, I love you. We get on the phone. He checks in all the time. And so just that being considerate of a woman's feelings and her emotions. Not only that, but being humble enough to understand where you come from, because you saw some things happen to your mother. So how about everything that you saw, reverse it? Be that man. Well, first of all, just be a man. Mm-hmm. That's important. Be a man. Be present.
And being a man is being emotionally attentive, sensitive, and courteous to a woman, right? That's manhood.
That's it.
In 2013, you set up Smooth, S-M-O-O-O-T-H, Inc. It's a nonprofit for domestic violence campaigns, speaking mentally, outwardly, opening opportunities toward healing. Tell us about Smooth.
Smooth is my baby. I founded Smooth 7 years ago. I'm fortunate enough to have two different chapters, one in Houston and one in South Carolina. So what we do is, of course, we advocate against domestic violence, but more so, we go out and we show women that there is hope after the fact. Mm-hmm. I knew that I wasn't in a position to be a rescuer or go and, you know, and do preventative things, which that is a part of it, but that's not the essence of what we stand for. I wanted to be on the transitional part where,
exactly,
where women, yeah, are coming out of, yeah, the hurt and showing them that they can heal and showing promise and hope. And I wanted to stand for that. Like, so my presence alone, my testimony, everything that I've been through, I wanted these women to see me and to see that all this work that I put in, this is what happens. I want to stand strong as a beautiful Black woman. I want you to see this. And so I think the biggest part for me is the counseling. I get to do one-on-one with most of these women, mm-hmm, and just follow their journeys from just being like broken. And then to get a call and say, Miss Sabrina, I got my child in school. Miss Sabrina, we're doing good. That makes me feel so, I mean, it just boosts my ego, because I'm thinking, yes, you know, another one that, yeah, that could have failed, that, you know, that could have died. And here they are, they're thriving. So it's very important that we continue this mission.
I'm so proud of you, because when I call you courageous and for survivors, we're all courageous, because I always say the most courageous thing you can do is make it through the day, to just live, right? Don't try to be like, oh, I have to accomplish this million things before I'm worth it. No, you were worth it the day God allowed you to come into this planet. That's what made you worth it.
That's it. You're okay to just be who you are.
Exactly. Yeah. And we all every day have our tough days. That's what people don't understand. But it's okay.
Yes.
That's part of it. It's okay. You know what I mean? And so what are the other kids doing? Keisha, Marcus, Shani.
Keisha is doing real estate in Houston. She is not leaving Houston. She loves it. So she is a certified trainer, fitness trainer. She's selling real estate. Keisha is doing really good. She's selling houses. And she's a part of DeAndre's real estate team also. So wow. She handles property for him. So she loves Houston. She's the best kid. And then you have Marcus. He's here in South Carolina. He's following up on his music career. So he is my artistic child. He can sing.
Wow.
Now everybody else thinks they can sing, but Marcus can really sign. And then of course he has three kids here. So he's being this amazing father to his children. So he's being present in their lives, which I love. Marcus is a good father. And then we have DeAndre, which we all know about, is in Arizona, breaking records, making strides. And then you have Shantaria. So Shantaria, I'm so proud of her. She is following her modeling career. So she just signed with one of the biggest modeling agencies in Arizona. And she had a photo shoot just a few days ago, which she nailed and killed it. And she's actually working with Golden Goose. So, and DeAndre is, he has some affiliation with Golden Goose. And so it's only befitting that Shantara works for the company. So yeah, that's where they are.
Sabrina, you done good.
Thank you.
You done did good.
I done good, I think. I think, yeah, hey, you know, a lot of prayer, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. But overall, you know, them little knuckleheads, they turned out pretty good.
I'll have to say they turned out really good. I mean, really good all around. And not just because DeAndre Hopkins is a star wide receiver and a future Hall of Famer. Yes, I said that. But also to imagine what Sabrina went through. She was left for dead, coming home, and still finding the courage, the strength, and will to still mother her kids back to health as she was also nursing herself back to health. Now that's true courage. And also when Sabrina talked about why DeAndre left Houston when he was traded to the Cardinals. And hearing how Bill O'Brien wouldn't even address DeAndre is really an indictment on a toxic coaching and lack of interpersonal communication skills by many coaches in our league. The confusion of power as leadership instead of communication. Which leads me to today's Annie's Clapback. Life is going to deal us all some heavy hands if it hasn't already done so. But what I liked most about what Sabrina did with her children, she showed them vulnerability, which is true leadership. She didn't say, I'm the mom, so you do as I say. No. She gathered them up. She told them in order for them to get through this, they're going to have to get through this together. That meant each of them doing their part, lifting each other up and holding each other accountable. And honestly, that's what teamwork is all about. Whether in a family or in a sport, teamwork is truly about communication and togetherness. As always, thank you so much for listening. Raising a Pro is part of the Audio Boom Originals Network. And if you haven't already, please make sure you rate, review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on another episode. See you next time, family.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.